Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
You're listening to Slice of Cheese with Jenny Linford on Food FM. Savour the crunch of Peter's Yard sourdough crackers. Available at Waitrose, Tesco, Sainsbury's, Morrison's, Ocado, Amazon and specialist food retailers.
To find out more about Food FM and our content, go to foodfmradio.com.
Hello, welcome to A Slice of Cheese, the Food FM radio series that celebrates the world of cheese. I'm Jenny Linford, a food writer and cheese enthusiast, the author of Great British Cheeses. Cheese is a delicious and fascinating food, and we're setting out to explore this remarkable food and share the stories of the people who make, sell and love it.
Blue cheeses are so distinctive and characterful. They have a Marmite aspect, with people either loving or hating them. I'm firmly a blue cheese lover, so thoroughly enjoyed making this episode. Spanish cheese expert Rupert Linton of Brindisa, the Spanish food company, takes me on a journey through the rich world of Spain's blue cheeses, including Cabrales. British cheesemaker Mary Davenport tells a story of Coat Hill Blue, and cheese writer Patrick McGuigan, co-author with Matthew Carver of Cheese Life, tells me about France's iconic Roquefort cheese.
Online, on smart speakers, and on Listen Again, this is Food FM.
This week on A Slice of Cheese, we're looking at the wonderful world of blue cheeses. I'm very happy to have with me today Rupert Linton of Brindisa, the Spanish quality food importers who've done so much to sort of trailblaze Spanish ingredients here in the UK. Good morning, Rupert.
Good morning, Jenny.
I was thinking about Spanish cheese, and I think, you know, lots of people have heard, I think, of Manchego, but perhaps they're less familiar with the Spanish blue cheeses. And I thought it'd be really interesting to get your thoughts. I mean, there's a sort of a really distinctive group of blue cheeses in Spain, isn't there? It is a big part of Spanish cheese culture.
Yeah, definitely, yes. There's an area in northern Spain, in the mountains of Asturias, just west of the Basque country, really, which is, I think, as the heartland of Spanish blue cheeses. There's Cabrales is probably the most famous or notorious
Spanish
blue cheeses.
Powerful, you know, yes, it's sort of, you can feel like it's a beast of a cheese. I think it might even be on your Brindisa website. It's pokey, isn't it? It's potent, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it's a really powerful cheese, but strangely compulsive as well. Once you've started eating it, it's very enjoyable. You can't taste anything for the rest of the day, but that's it.
That's good to know. I think, did you mention the mountain? That it was mountainous, which I'm guessing is relevant.
Yes. So what makes this area of Asturias special and appropriate for blue cheese is that it's a mountain range, which is about 40 kilometres inland from the coast in the Bay of Biscay. It's a limestone mountain range, so it's got some of the deepest caves in the world. It's a very popular place for potholing, and so traditionally the farmers have in that area have used these limestone caves for aging cheeses, and one of the requirements for the Cabrales denomination of origin is that your cave needs to have a stream running through it.
It's amazing. So that's a particular humidity in the air then to help the cheese.
Yes. I mean, I must say it doesn't seem to be that difficult, because whenever you go into these caves, there's, you know, the stalactites, and there's water like dripping down.
Lots of dripping. It's very atmospheric to visit them. Then you visited some of them.
Because a lot of them don't have any electricity. So when you go in, you know, you're wearing a head torch, like a mountaineering head torch. to get in there. And in the Cabrales that we import from a cheesemaker called Pepe Bada, his highest cave, he has to take the cheeses up by in his rucksack. Right. He always takes advantage of all the visitors, and everyone gets a rucksack full of cheese to take up.
Quite sensible.
Share the load.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So could you tell us about Cabrales? So it is, you know, it is this notorious blue cheese. What is it like in terms of sort of shape, size, texture?
Well, Cabrales they're kind of like a flat disc. They tend to be about 2 kilos. Normally, when we get a kind of like a younger Cabrales, so it's about 2 months, 2.5 months old. But even then, the bluing is really quite defined. I suppose what's unusual about the Cabrales is that it's a more compact cheese. So say if you can imagine like a Stilton or a Pecos, they've got the way that the cheese is the structure of the cheese, it's got more holes in it. You know, it allows more oxygen into to allow the blue to
the bluing. Yeah.
Whereas Cabrales is pretty solid, really.
Ah, interesting.
And it's solid and creamy. And I mean, there's lots of different Cabrales makers, but the Cabrales dairies that I visited, they rely on natural bluing.
I was going
they
to
have
ask
kind them of that. Rooms that just allow the air of the mountains to flow through right. You know, insect screens
over the cheeses.
Just over the cheeses, and they blue naturally. Yeah,
right. Because that a lot of blue cheese making is more controlled, isn't it? In that. I think often it's penicillin roqueforti, as I understand it, that's put in into the milk to allow. And then the oxygen, a cheese like Stilton is pierced to get the oxygen because that will allow the blue to grow and spread, which is sort of what blue cheesemakers want. So it's interesting. So they're just working with nature then.
And some of the Cabrales, what they do sometimes is they'll break up the cheese into a paste and then reform it. So that makes them kind of much more potent and much more kind of uniformly blue, like more like blue tack in a way, you can say that kind of color. That kind of
that's interesting. And when you were choosing because you source very carefully at Brindisi, did you have a particular style of Cabrales that you wanted? You mentioned the maker. Is it something
well,
you done?
Yes. I mean, we wanted one that wasn't, you know, going to blow your head off, really. That was our criteria. We wanted one, and we wanted one that was consistent. And because one of the things that happened with Cabrales, like originally in the midst of time, is that it was a cooperative. And so when you bought the Cabrales, you had to buy from the cooperative, and so you never knew which dairy you were buying from. So sometimes you could buy the most amazing Cabrales, and the next time you could buy one which was just more, you know, run of the mill. And so it was very difficult to kind of guarantee quality because you never knew what dairy was going to come from. and it was one of the changes that they did to the cooperative was to allow cheesemakers to sell their own cheese directly to the public.
That's interesting.
And then people had much more interest in improving the quality of the cheese that they made. It's been very successful, really. Yeah,
good. And is it probably popular in Spain, Cabrales?
It's very popular in Asturias. I mean, one of my colleagues at work, I mean, she used to have Cabrales sandwiches to, you know, at school in the break.
Wow.
And, I mean, Cabrales is cheese in Asturias. It's all Cabrales. That's what people like.
I was wondering in the way, you know, that we have Stilton at Christmas time. I was wondering if there was that tradition in Spain of eating it at Christmas. Was it just, but it's just widely eaten in Asturias through the year then?
Yes, it's eaten all year. And in Spain, the tradition it more is to eat is seafood at Christmas, you know, kind of goose barnacles and things like that.
So Cabrales is this famous blue cheese in Spain. What are some of the other cheeses, Rupert?
One of the other blue cheeses from Asturias, which I find really fascinating, is one called Gamoneo, which is a valley which is kind of adjacent to the valley of Cabrales. They've still got some like really traditional cheesemakers there who use, say, like a blend of milks. So if you imagine, you know, the Middle Ages, you had your goats, your sheep and your cows, you just send them out onto the hillside. And then when they came back at the end of the day, you'd milk them. And all that milk just goes into the same vat.
Right.
So you never know how much cow, goat, or you don't know the proportions.
Yeah.
And so there's a couple of people who still make the cheese in that way. So there's a random element to it. And the Gamonneau also uses natural bluing. And for a Spanish cheese, it's strangely similar to a British territorial in texture.
Oh,
it's got that kind of dry crumbliness, you know, say of you know, Lancashire or something like that.
Yeah.
But and also because they rely on blue and natural bluing, they also do something which is unusual in cheese making, which is, means they don't turn the cheeses. So and they're quite big, you know, they're like a Stilton, they're kind of eight kilo cheeses. So you'll get like the lower half will be quite blue.
Yeah.
But there's more moisture, and then the upper half will be white.
Gosh, creamy white, that's fascinating, white color.
And that's, you know, I don't know why they just that's just how they do it. That's how they like it.
Yeah.
And it's a delicious cheese as well. It's, you know, it's one which is, you know, it's definitely growing in popularity in Spain because of the, you know, the way the animals are treated. They're out on the hillside. They're eating natural pastures. It's raw milk. You know, there's loads of aspects of and they're what's the word, they're shepherd cheesemakers or herder cheesemakers.
Yes.
So it's like quite a long day, quite a long working day.
Right, yes.
For them. Yeah.
Yes, and massive, you know, that's a venerable tradition, isn't it? Wasn't it when you said about not knowing the ratio of milk, you know, it's just done as what's there. And I was thinking I make a bramble jelly in the autumn. I go and pick whatever I find. So it's like, you know, rose hips, hopefully some blackberries, but hopefully rose hips, I love the flavour. Crab apples, elderberries. And what's really nice is I can never repeat it because it was just sort of fun because you know, I never really know what I found. I put it in and then the flavour will vary. It must rather like for the cheesemakers.
Yeah. Yeah, so sometimes it's kind of superb, but then they can never, you know, you have to just thoroughly enjoy it while you've got it.
Yes.
Yeah.
And what are some of the other blues in Spain then?
Well, there's I mean, in that range of mountains in the Picos in Asturias, there's a new cheese called it's called Mama Marisa, which is made by a dairy called Reisilo in Asturias, and they've developed, you know, it's a new cheese which they've developed, and it's very much based on British recipes, British cheese making recipes.
Yeah.
And they've got, because in that part of Asturias, they've got such a similar climate to us. You know, there's Atlantic weather coming in, there's very green pastures, there's a tradition of raising cows, of dairy. And so they've, you know, it's a superb cheese. I mean, it's absolutely delicious. So, yeah, but very similar to, you know, to a Stilton. Or
I was going to say,
like,
is it like a Stilton? Because I remember one of the things you've told me before, Rupert, is that the Spanish cheese is very fascinating because it's got, you know, it's great traditions, but also there is this, as in Britain, a sort of innovative, you know, new people making new cheeses and playing around and experimenting, which must be very exciting for you as a cheese lover to see.
It's really inspiring, actually. I mean, there's kind of like two different kind of generations, I'd say. There's a generation who, you know, they've been brought up as cheesemakers and they make the recipe that's always been made. And then there's a kind of bit like a, well, you could say a younger generation who are inspired by, you know, a lot by what's been going on in the UK, but also by the United States.
Yes.
And there's a young cheesemaker who makes a cheese called Picon Treviso, which is another neighbouring valley.
Mm-hmm.
And he's gone back to using it's an Asturian brown cow as opposed to a Frisian cow. So it's got a tastier milk, it's got lower production.
Yeah.
And he's also renovated his caves. So when he took over the dairy from his father, he's kind of tweaked things and kind of modernized his facilities, improved hygiene massively, and changed the breed. So even with these like very traditional, you know, mountain villages, you know, people do innovate, quite a lot. Yeah.
I mean, that's interesting about the breed of the cow, because that often comes up on, I mean, perhaps the example that leapt to my mind in Britain was Johnny Crickmore, who's in Suffolk, who makes Baron Bigod, and they were dairy farms, and he was told by Ivan Lutch, one of the very famous sort of cheese gurus in the world of cheese, that he needed different cow, he needed different milk, better milk for cheese making, and recommended Montbéliard's. And Johnny went off and got, you know, came back, sold his cows. It's a really big thing to do, you know, and swapped, you know, change breed. But it's, you know, it's all worked, it's all gone beautifully because he's making a very respected and very popular cheese. Are there ways that Spaniards enjoy eating blue cheese? Would it be after a meal, or is it, you know, is it served as a tapas?
Well, I mean, I have had it. There's a tapa in northern Spain, you could say, which is like a blue cheese kind of mixed with cream or with cream cheese, served on endives with walnuts.
Oh, that sounds very nice.
That's quite nice. Yeah.
Yeah.
They make a blue cheese sauce to go with steak.
Right.
And I have had, you know, there's quite an experimental branch of Spanish gastronomy, and so I have had blue cheese ice cream as well, which was
of course you had, which was different.
I have made. I found a very interesting, very good recipe off the internet for blue cheese ice cream, and it had a couple of tablespoons of honey. It was really very good, actually.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting because when you talk about pairing blue cheese, you know, it does go very well with sweetness because of that sort of salty savouriness. Sweetness works very well as a partnership.
I mean, in Spain, lots of times it'll be paired with a Pedro Ximénez sherry, which has got this kind of sweet, kind of, you know, raisiny.
Yes. I was thinking of Muscatel raisins, which I'm addicted to. It's lovely dried. They've got such a beautiful flavour.
I mean, Cabrales and Muscatel raisins are, for me, a match made in heaven.
Lovely.
It's a really good, really good combination.
Yes. Okay. Well, that is wonderful. Thank you, Rupert. That was I love the way your knowledge of the geography of Spain is so, really comes out when you talk to me about cheese. So it was lovely to have you back on the podcast. Thank you, Rupert.
No, thank you.
I'm a huge fan of Peter's Yard's crackers, and they go beautifully with cheese. All Peter's Yard's crackers are made in small batches using quality natural ingredients and their sourdough starter, slowly fermented for 16 hours for award-winning flavour and crunch.
Online, on smart speakers, and on Listen Again. This is Food FM.
Savour the crunch of Peter's Yard sourdough crackers. Available at Waitrose, Tesco, Sainsbury's, Morrison's, Ocado, Amazon, and specialist food retailers.
This week on A Slice of Cheese, we're looking at the world of blue cheeses. And while Stilton is probably, you know, Britain's most famous and certainly most historic blue cheese, there are many other blue cheeses in Britain. So very happy to have with me today Mary Davenport of Coathill Cheese, who make Coathill Blue. Hello, Mary.
Hello, Jenny.
Thank you so much, Mary, for taking the time, because I know how busy cheesemakers are. First of all, I'd be lovely to hear the story of Coathill Cheese. How did it come about? As I gather, you were farmers, is that right, to begin with? Dairy farmers, I'm assuming.
Dairy farmers. Well, we came, my husband's parents came to the farm in 1965, or the early 1960s.
In Lincolnshire, this is, isn't it?
In Lincolnshire, right? Yeah. I'm a farmer's daughter from just up the road. And I met Michael, and the farm we were on was a very mixed farm. And I married Michael and came down and learned all about dairy cows, which is a whole different ball game.
I bet, yes. Mm. Yeah, there must have been a lot of learning. And what, and dairy, you know, I've had quite a few of the sort of farmhouse cheesemakers have had, you know, it's been very tough for dairy farmers because of the sort of, you know, the way the milk prices fluctuated and gone down, sadly. Is that one of the reasons why you, that took you down the road to cheesemaking?
That's the very reason. Michael loves his cows. And just wanted to keep cows on the farm. The farm is a small farm, 184 acres, and the fields we've always kept small paddocks, basically, which are ideal for dairy cows. And he wanted to keep the cows above everything else. And so I was working at the time, and Michael decided to investigate cheesemaking. And this was nearly 20 years ago.
Gosh, amazing.
So he took himself off on a cheesemaking course at Nantwich with the wonderful Chris Ashby. I don't know if you know her. And
I've heard the name, yes, it's come up. Interesting, yeah.
Chris Ashby and Val Bynes ran this course.
Yes, and I thought Val Bynes has come up a lot too. I was talking to Mary Quick, who was talking, I think Val went there and worked with them. So
And Michael went off for 2.5-3 days over to Cheshire and came back and said, we can do this. the royal we.
Excellent.
I'd always loved baking, and with four children, it was a necessity, really. And so he knew that the skills would transfer.
Right.
Michael had always made homemade beer.
Oh, interesting. That is interesting.
Very interesting, a similar way of managing cleanliness and bacteria. And so it all sort of quite fitted in, and he was very, very excited. And we had no money, but my brother-in-law very kindly said, "I'll buy you a cheese vat."
Oh, that was kind. Yes.
Wasn't it lovely? So he invested in our first 200-litre cheese vat, and we bought the moulds. And we a friend of a friend knew somebody who supplied cheese-making equipment. And at that time, there wasn't a lot out there to access in the way of equipment. But anyway, we found these moulds, and they came, and off we went.
Even in buying moulds, you're making a choice, aren't you? Had you already decided a sort of, A, had you decided a blue cheese? And if so, what you know, why a blue cheese? And did you also then think about the shape and size of it?
Yeah, well, on the, yes, we decided on a blue cheese because we quite liked blue cheese. And Michael said, well, if we're going to make cheese, we might as well make something that we like.
Yeah.
And so we'd been buying Saint Augur and Cambazola, and we'd leaned towards the softer cheeses. I quite liked Stilton when it was milder, but not when it got stronger. And so part of the course was making a soft blue cheese, and Michael said, well, it wasn't quite soft enough, so I'm going to do this, this and this. And we didn't realise that when you're making cheese, you only change one thing at once because you don't know otherwise what works. We didn't realise that at the time. We were quite naive. But Michael said, I want to try this, this and this. Our first batch is pretty much the same cheese that we make now.
That's remarkable. Gosh, you were very lucky because some people spend ages.
And
you
we didn't find that out until a good time later when we talked to other cheesemakers, obviously, and they said, well, how long was it before you got this cheese? And we
it just sort of happened.
Did it?
Bingo. That is brilliant. And so and I had a piece of it, so I don't really know what is the size. What do you have, different sizes, or is that
we
just started making it? Is there one size?
We have two sizes, and obviously the cheese has evolved over the years, but it's about 1.3 kilos. It's the size of a Victoria sandwich cake.
Lovely.
Very easy to portion.
And so having taken that plunge into cheesemaking, which you seem to have embraced with great enthusiasm, how did you then get it out? You know, how do you start taking it to market? Was it farmers markets, or did you get cheese?
Yes, basically. So we make the larger cutting cheese, and then we make a smaller individual cheese, which is not tiny. It's about 360 grams. It's a reasonable sized small blue.
Yeah.
And so we went off with these cheeses, and I just went to anything and everything locally, and we in the first year I'd got the energy and the enthusiasm, and so off I went, and that's how we marketed it pretty much.
You know, when you've got a food that's good, I mean, it's funny because people often grumble about farmers markets, but when I talk to farmers and other food producers, they're often very, very important ways of getting, you know, especially when you're making something new, getting it to market. And as you get the feedback, because you are literally giving it out, people try it, they can tell you, you know, and you see whether they like it or not, which is really useful, isn't it?
Yeah, really, really encouraging to actually take it and let people try it and to get that all important feedback.
I talked to a lovely Northern Irish cheesemaker. He's making a raw milk blue cheese, and he said he'd set up at a market, and he sort of watched this guy come over the cobbles towards him. He thought, oh, I got a wee sale coming up. And the guy came over and said to him, I didn't like blue cheese, and then walked away. And he'd come over all the way to tell Mike that he didn't like what he was making. So I feel that's rewarding.
Absolutely. One of those gritted teeth experiences, isn't it? Where you say, right, well, disappear then.
And actually, to go back to the milk, yours is a raw milk blue, is that correct?
Yes.
And was that is that something that was very important to you, to make a raw milk cheese?
Well, it was. We'd entered the dairy competitions in Lincolnshire. There were at that time there were quite a few milk producers in Lincolnshire, and Michael had always entered the competitions for everything that they did. And he'd all, well, a number of years, won the Clean Milk Trophy.
Oh, fantastic.
And it grieved him a little bit that the lorry came trundling down the lane and took our clean milk and put it in the tank with everybody else's milk, whatever quality it was. Yes. And so it always miffed him a little bit. When he went on the cheesemaking course, he was with other enthusiasts of all sorts from all walks of life. And one of them was a cheese buyer. And Michael picked his brains and said, well, what kind of cheese would be the best one to make? And he said, oh, raw milk, blue cheese, that is the most difficult. And Michael thought, I like a challenge. And pinged, you know, and he thought, right, here we go. So, and my clean milk, I know I've got clean milk, and off we went.
That's very, isn't that interesting? And I mean, they must be very satisfying when I've talked to other dairy farmers, and yes, sending their milk away, not knowing what happened to it. And there's such a difference when the farmer uses the milk that they've given from their cows or other animals, sheep or goats, and then turns it into cheese. That sort of excitement of actually then being able to, you know, you're making something from your milk. And, and that must be very rewarding from that whole cycle, I suppose. It must be very meaningful because you're looking after your animals in order to get the milk. So do you have to change the breed? What breed were your cows at this point?
We were a cross between Holsteins and Friesians. And all we've really done is gone a little bit more down the Friesian route, and we've added some brown Swiss.
Right. What were for cheese-making reasons, the brown Swiss?
Yes, and because they're quite hardy and they're good grazers. And they add a bit of beauty to the herd.
Yeah, lovely. How many cows do you have on the farm?
We're a little bit down, between 70 and 80, and then 40-ish followers. So right. Young stock.
Yes. So not huge, is it? Interesting.
No. Yeah. No.
Yeah. No. And how, so obviously you made, you know, so you, Michael had this idea of making cheese and making the blue cheese and you found a market for it. How does that pattern then of cheese making, how often do you make cheese on the farm? You know, talk me through a week, I suppose, at Cote Hill Farm.
Well, we make cheese 4 days a week now. Right. We were pretty flexible at first because it was just myself and Michael, so we could say, well, I won't make cheese today, I've got too many other things to do. So the milk went in the tank at that time. There was no problem with who we sold the milk to. It didn't matter that there was 200 or 300 litres less or more.
Right.
And so, but now we're into a pattern and we make 4 days a week, and then Friday is wash down day.
Right.
And finishing off everything. And then obviously the staff have Saturday and Sunday off. So very civilised.
Very civilised.
Except dear Christmas.
Oh, well, yes, quite. Yeah. And for, you know, yes, Christmas is such a busy time, isn't it? So tell me about the making. So are you using Penicillin Roqueforti? Is that, you know, when you make the cheese?
Yeah. Yeah.
And is the cheese pierced in order to get it?
Yeah. Yes. And we have always side pierced rather than top pierced. And we did at one stage consult Chris and say, what would happen if we top pierced? And she said, well, it would change your cheese completely. So stuck with side piercing and didn't want to change that. We're quite happy with side piercing. I hand pierced during the time that I made cheese, but we did get a machine that puts the cheese on its side, and then needles come in sideways and pierce it. So it works quite well. So now, obviously, when you employ staff, it's a bit safer if they put the cheese in a machine, and it works.
Just thinking of that course you'd done, did Michael go back to Chris, you know, with some of the cheese he'd made and say, I've made this, try, you know, was there that moment where she got to try it?
Well, she did in a roundabout way, only when we sort of, I can't remember how we came upon the British Cheese Awards and entered our cheese, but we did. We entered our cheese, must be in 2006. I think we made our first batches in 2004, 2005, and then 2006 we entered. And we got a gold medal, so that really, really buoyed us up. And that took our cheese to the rest of the country, really.
We should describe a Cope Hill cheese because it's got a very particular... I mean, it's delicious. I had some the other day and it was really nice, Mary. For lunch, it was a very civilised lunch. I had sourdough bread, tasted... spread your cheese on it because it is soft. It does have a sort of spreadable quality to it, mm-hmm. and put walnuts on it and had a salad, like a nice crisp salad on the side. And it was really lovely.
Thank you.
I thought it was quite had sort of mushroomy flavour to it.
Yeah, that's perfect.
Good. It's always a risk when you start talking something whose cheese they've made. So did you have this? It's a soft blue. That was your style. So Michael wanted that soft. You both wanted that soft texture.
Yes,
didn't you?
Yes, we did. We wanted that soft blue, and so we cut the curd larger than Michael had learned on his course, and we ladled it out very gently. And we still do that. I've been helping them fill this morning, and it's still exactly the same. Just ladle the curds out,
and that gentle handling is to keep the moisture, to keep the curd intact. And how long does it stay on the farm for?
4 weeks. It matures. We leave it in the make room overnight, draining. The next morning, it is dry salted, and then the next day, day three, it is moved through to the maturation room at 12 degrees.
Did you have to put that in specially once you got up and running?
We started with a cold store, a maturation room, and a make room.
Okay,
we got a grant, fortunately, and I had a little bit of savings, and we used the savings together with the grant, and we had enough money to put up the three rooms.
You made your cheese perfectly first time.
Yes. And then the first year I made three tons of cheese. We started August, and it was on the market for Christmas.
And
we were very fortunate that we had a company called Parkview Foods in Market Raisin, and their business was artisan cheese primarily, and they were great supporters. Helped us get the cheese out there. Yeah, we had it on the market for Christmas, and they were obviously very excited to have a new soft blue cheese, along with Lincolnshire Poacher, of course.
Yes, are they nearby? I love Lincolnshire Poacher. They're wonderful
cheese. They're very nearby. And again, we work very well together. We always say theirs is the hard cheese in Lincolnshire, more mature. Yeah. Ours are the soft cheeses. We say they're not strong, but they do have flavour.
Very beautifully put and absolutely true. I tried Lincolnshire Poacher did this. Because of lockdown, I think it's called the Big 50 or something.
Poacher
50, that's right. Which was made in, because of lockdown, they made it a different recipe to mature for longer because of the uncertainty. They wanted to, to make sure their milk was good use. It was really delicious. And I was impressed because, 3 years is a long time. And yet, actually, it still had a sort of softness and a fruitiness to the cheese. It was very, very good. How did you, Michael, find the world of cheese? From the world of farming, entering the world of cheese, coming into contact with retailers, I presume, and customers. What was that like for you? Was it nice to sort of be able to connect people through cheese, something you've made, a food you've made?
Oh, absolutely. And cheesemakers are very, very good at sharing information. Mm. And, you sort of ask questions. Well, how do you get around this? And what about this? And so good at just passing it on and enthusiastic. And there's always some new information to be found. It's lovely. we've met some wonderful people and made some lovely friends.
And have local restaurants been keen to use your cheese either in cooking or to put it on their cheese boards?
Yeah, always. Local restaurants, local farm shops, Lincolnshire Co-op, just the Lincolnshire Co-op. We cook cheese for them. That's really helpful. Local chefs, really enthusiastic.
And so of the milk on your farm, how much of it goes towards the cheese now?
About a third at the moment. So we... Right. that we like to keep the lorry coming down the road because that gives us flexibility.
Quite useful, isn't it?
Yes. It means that if somebody's on, because we're only a small staff, if somebody's on holiday, you can bet your life that somebody else is poorly.
That's the golden rule.
And then Joe, our son, is suddenly in the cheese room on his own, and he said, I'll put the milk in the tank today, I think.
So your son has got involved in the cheese. How long is it starting down? That's lovely.
Yes. So Joe decided to join us in 2010.
Oh, brilliant. Oh, okay. Yeah.
So that's
did he have a background? Had he done something totally different? And then, I mean, obviously he grew up on the farm, but had he gone off and done something and then come back to it?
Yeah. He went off. He was working surveying gas pipelines.
Gosh, quite different.
Quite different. Yeah, he did an engineering design course at university. Got this job surveying pipelines and travelled quite a lot with the job. It was a very interesting job, but as with quite a lot of jobs, it became as he worked more, it became more office based and reports and paperwork. Yeah. He does not like paperwork. much prefers to be hands-on, practical, fixing things, making cheese, and it all fitted in. And I always say he's a much, much better cheesemaker than I am. He's more methodical.
Right. Do you think that's important? I mean, I'm not a cheesemaker. Mm. And in fact, I'm not. Yes, and I do cook, you know, a lot. But baking, I always think baking, you've got to be very precise when you bake. Cakes. Are you not? But you think that methodical is different.
I am, but Joe has a much greater attention to detail. So much more careful with his pHs, monitoring his measurements, which improves the cheese, obviously.
Mm. And Christmas and blue cheese, is Christmas your busy time, Mary?
Yeah. It is, yes. We are more busy at Christmas, but generally, we have a nice steady flow, and January is quieter, but it's quite quick when the orders start to come back in.
That's right.
We're quite lucky, really.
And one last question, Mary. So I enjoyed your cheese spread on toast with walnuts. Is there a way that you like eating your own cheese, or you know, would you serve it to your family in a particular way? I just wondered if there was something you were fond of.
I just like it with crackers and grapes. I love grapes. Ah, and also the other thing is pear. Pear and blue cheese is really lovely.
Good. It's a lovely cheese. Congratulations to you. And how nice that you've got your son is involved too. And
thank you.
And it made a difference, I'm guessing, to your, you know, to the sort of economy of the farm. You found a way of making it viable for you.
Oh, yes. Yes, it certainly has. And now we employ, 10 people, some part-time, some full-time, but it's great to be able to do that and keep cows on the farm.
Wonderful. Oh, well, thank you for taking the time, Mary. Much appreciated.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's a pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
With their delightfully crunchy texture, Peter's Yard sourdough crackers go very well with cheese. The crackers come in a lovely range of flavours, so you can have fun experimenting with matching them to different cheeses. You can really taste the fig in the fig and spelt sourdough crackers. The natural sweetness of these crackers makes them an excellent partner to blue cheeses such as Roquefort, Gorgonzola, or Stilton. For further suggestions, have a look at the cheese pairing wheel on the Peter's Yard website.
Online, on smart speakers, and on Listen Again. This is Food FM.
Savour the crunch of Peter's Yard sourdough crackers. Available at Waitrose, Tesco, Sainsbury's, Morrison's, Ocado, Amazon and specialist food retailers.
I'm very happy to have with me again Patrick McGuigan, cheese writer and educator, author of great cheese books, with his latest being The Cheese Life, co-written with Matthew Carver. Hello, Patrick.
Hi, Jenny.
Very nice to have you back on my podcast. I always enjoy conversations, Patrick. This week we're looking at blue cheese, and that term blue cheese, you know, which I sort of bandy about. What does it actually mean? What are blue cheeses? I thought we could start in a really fundamental way. What does it mean?
Well, that's a good question. I suppose what makes a blue cheese is the colour inside the cheese, where you have a particular type of mould growing Which gives this green to blue colour to the cheese, and so you get veining or sort of pockets of this mould growing. The main mould variety, there's one type which is called Penicillium Roqueforti, and that is what makes blue cheese blue.
And that's a really good visual clue. So, I mean, they're very recognisable, aren't they, when you go into a cheese shop and you can see blue cheese. And they do seem to me to be cheese that sort of divide. You know, some people love blue cheese and some people don't like them. And obviously I'm aware there are many, many different blue cheeses. But are there characteristics overall in terms of or flavour? Or is there just a massive sort of range of flavours you would get from the presence of that mould?
So what happens with the way the mould gets into the cheese is it's added by the cheesemaker as a powdered spores of this mold. I mean, it's part of the fungus family, so it's added to the milk typically, and then what you need to do with a blue cheese in the maturing room is you need to spike it. So obviously a mold is not going to grow without oxygen. It's a living organism. So blue cheeses are spiked, and then once that air goes in, the mold comes to life, has a good food source and starts to grow. And what it's doing as it grows inside the cheese is it releases enzymes, this mold, which break down the fats and the proteins in the cheese during maturation. And as that happens, you get different flavours.
Right.
So typically with blue cheese, you know, a lot of the things that people associate with blue cheese are things like sort of spicy, peppery notes. Mm-hmm. Often you get sort of almost like alcoholic, fruity notes. So pear and pear drops is a flavour that I often pick up in blue cheeses. And that is to do with how the proteins and the fats are being broken down by this blue mould. But there's a huge range of styles of blue cheese. So, you know, I suppose if you go from sort of intensity levels, you know, you can start with something like Cambazola or Montagnolo, a thin, which are two German cheeses actually, but sort of sound like they might be French or Italian, Gorgonzola Dolce, which are on the more sort of mild end. And I would say at the more sort of the very intense, spicy end of things there's a cheese called Cabrales made in Asturias, which is very intense, has quite a lot of that sort of power and spice. A lot of that is to do with how the cheeses are matured, but also there are different strains of Penicillium Roqueforti. So Penicillium Roqueforti is one type of mould, but within that there are different strains. So sometimes you'll get strains that are sort of milder and lighter in colour. You know, you can see sort of like sort of pastel green colours through to sort of dark indigo blues. And they'll break the cheese down in slightly different ways and at different rates and give you different flavours.
Interesting. My Christmas wouldn't be complete without Stilton. We have to mention that very famous British blue cheese there, I think, too. And with a Causton Bassett Stilton, to be specific, and a Neal's Yard Dairy Causton Bassett Stilton, to be even more specific. and also there's Osis Tichelton, which is another wonderful cheese made from raw milk, unlike Stilton. When you mentioned Penicillium Roqueforti, probably one of the great famous blue cheeses in the world is Roquefort. That's something you've written about Roquefort, Patrick, in another of your books called The Philosophy of Cheese. It's got a lot of mythology, I think, associated with it, hasn't it? Tell us that story.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm glad you mentioned Stilton, because I think it's, before we get onto Roquefort, but Stilton is one of the great European blue cheeses. And I think as a country, we should cherish Stilton and eat it, not just at Christmas. It is a remarkable and delicious cheese. And I agree, Colston Bassett's excellent. I quite like Cropwell Bishop as well. Anyway, Roquefort, you know, another one of, I suppose, the three great blue cheeses of Europe are Gorgonzola, Stilton and Roquefort, I would say. And Roquefort in France has a really long history. And in the research for the philosophy of cheese, you know, there's evidence of Roquefort being matured in the caves of Roquefort in the south of France from a 1070. So you're talking a 1,000-year-old cheese. Yeah, so it's, you know, and it's one of the cheeses that keeps popping up in French history, you know, so it's one of the great famous cheeses that was loved by nobility and is well known across the whole of France. It's not just a regional cheese by any means.
Right. That's interesting. And is there is a legend with its make? I mean, you often come across this in food, don't you? The sort of the happy mistake in a way. It's quite a trope that comes up in sort of, you know, in food legends, food urban myths, whatever you want to call them.
Yeah, you're talking about the classic love-struck shepherd, aren't you, Jenny?
I think I am.
Yes. So, you know, a good cheesemonger will tell you the story of the young shepherd in Aveyron, which is, you know, Roquefort is a place, we should make clear, in the south of France, a sort of central southern, in a region called Aveyron, which is the village of Roquefort is next to, what's important to understand is these amazing caves that are in the town of Roquefort, which essentially there was a mountain called Mont Combalou, which at some point in millions of years ago sort of collapsed and created this amazing sort of cliff face and lots of natural limestone caves, which, you know, before refrigeration, caves were where you wanted to keep your cheese because they're cool and have high humidity and you know, gentle airflow. So they're perfect for cheese. So the story goes that 1,000 years ago, a young shepherd with his flock of sheep was wandering sort of along near the caves of Roquefort, and stopped for lunch. And he had a plain, fresh sheep's milk cheese, so a sort of white cheese, and some rye bread. And he sat down for lunch in the mouth of one of the caves, and then saw a beautiful woman in the distance, and decided to leave his lunch and chase after this beautiful woman. He obviously got lucky because he didn't return for his lunch for a few days. And the story goes that when he returned, the rye bread had gone mouldy and lots of blue mould growing on it, and the cheese had gone mouldy. And being, an adventurous young shepherd, he tried this blue sheep's milk cheese. And lo and behold, it was delicious, and Roquefort was born. There is absolutely no evidence to prove any of that. It's a lovely myth. It's a good story, and you know, a good cheesemonger will tell you that. There's a very similar story to do with Gorgonzola and how Gorgonzola was discovered.
It sounds like familiar.
Very familiar, where a young cheesemaker chases off after a woman and his cheese turns blue and he tries it.
Yeah.
So who knows, but it's quite good fun. You know.
But the caves are very interesting, aren't they? Because again, the caves, Cabrales is matured in caves. Yes, I mean, it's always very interesting when the geography of place, you know, is present in a story. And blue cheeses, they do like moisture. I mean, am I right in thinking that? That's something that they often matured in quite humid conditions.
Yeah, cheese in general, you want to keep humidity high. You don't want cheeses to dry out during maturation. Roquefort is matured sort of 3 to 6 months. You know, up to 6 months, that's quite a long time for a blue cheese. Stilton's more like, is basically sort of 3 months, 12 weeks for Stilton.
But it's the making of Roquefort. Presumably that is, the French have been very good at protecting their historic foods and drinks legally. It's something they've done. I'm guessing that Roquefort has that. Does it have what's called a PDO?
It certainly has a PDO. It's actually arguably the first sort of protected food in history. So in 1411, King Charles VI sort of specified that Roquefort cheese could only be aged in the Combalou caves. So that's arguably the first sort of ever appellation for food in France was for Roquefort.
Amazing.
It certainly got its first, it was the first cheese to get an appellation d'origine contrôlée, an AOC. Mm-hmm. That was in 1925. And then, you know, with the advent of the EU, it has a protected designation of origin, which means that Roquefort can only be made with milk from the Lacun breed of sheep, which are quite a hardy sheep variety that fare well in that hot, rocky climate of where the cheese is made. It can only be made in Aveyron, Aude, Gard, Hérault, Lozère and Tarn, which is actually sounds quite a lot, but that's a very small area.
Right.
And by law, every wheel of Roquefort, which is typically about 3 kilos, must spend at least a couple of weeks in one of the 7 caves of Roquefort. So even if you're buying like a value Roquefort in a discount supermarket, if it says Roquefort, it's all of those things: raw milk made in Roquefort and will have been aged in in one of the caves.
Gosh, that's quite a maintaining of tradition, isn't it? That's really interesting. I was wondering, how would you characterise it? If someone hadn't eaten it, Patrick, what would you say, how would you describe it in terms of texture and flavour? But then I was also wondering whether maybe they're different, you know, depending on the affineur, perhaps, whether Roquefort can be taken in different directions, or is there a very characteristic Roquefort style because of these strict controls on how it's made?
No, they are different, you know, depending which producer you go for. I think Roquefort is typically saltier, you know, it's got a really salty tang to it compared to some other blues, certainly on that sort of milder end that I was talking about. I mentioned pear drops earlier, I often get like that fruity sort of like fermented, sort of slightly sort of fermented fruit, mm-hmm. almost boozy kind of flavour with Roquefort. I think it can also be quite.
That's a really good description of it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's got a great texture as well, Roquefort, which is quite. It's a soft cheese, but it has an almost like a sort of fondanty, like a fondant texture to it. Mm. So it can be a little bit grainy, but there's something about it. It's not like gooey, but it's got this lovely sort of firm yet soft sort of, yeah, like a fondant is the best way I can describe it.
Yeah.
Texture. Nice. And because, you know, it's very difficult to have sheep's milk all year round, you know, with cows and with goats, you can get them to calve and kid at different times in the year. So you have a year round milk supply. Mm-hmm. Sheep, that's very difficult. So it is quite a seasonal cheese. So, you know, milk supply is really from the sort of spring to autumn, the traditional period when, you know, our animals, the sheep lamb in the spring yeah. and give you milk during the summer. So the reason why you might get a 3 month Roquefort or a 6 month Roquefort is because they'll, you know, they have to mature them a bit longer to cover those winter periods where they're not getting milk. So, so you know, it can be, if you get a more mature Roquefort, they're going to be even spicier and sort of stronger. Mm-hmm. And a younger one will be more of that. Sometimes there's like a minerality, like a sort of quite nice mineral flavour to those younger ones. It's very hard to know what you're buying, you know, in a supermarket, sort of how old it is. It's quite hard to tell. But, you know, if you're buying Roquefort in the winter months, it's probably going to be a bit more mature than, you know, if you're buying it in the height of summer.
And what would you, are there pairings that you enjoy with Roquefort? Are there certain?
I said pears, you know, a slice of ripe pear with some Roquefort is a lovely sort of classic combination.
It's an elusive fruit to get a ripe pear.
Well, yeah, I know.
It's so tricky.
Even the sort of supermarket, you know, specially ripened premium tier pears are never really that ripe, are they? But you can get them.
Right, very exciting. I buy. I love commis pears, and I buy them from the market store. And the guy, you know, he says, "Oh, yeah, wait a bit. You know, any time I put them there, I'm just sort of check them every day, and then and I hope I haven't missed the moment, you know. And then when it's right, it is a joyous thing. And lovely with Roquefort.
The drink of choice would be Sauternes in France. A sweet white wine made in Bordeaux, which is not a million miles away. It's funny, that part of France, sort of southern France, is known for its very tannic red wines, you know, very powerful, robust reds, mm-hmm. Which I'm sure in that part of France is what people will drink because that's what's being made. But personally, I think, you know, tannic reds and a creamy, spicy blue don't always work so well. I think dessert, sort of sweet wines... Yeah. Work really well, anything with a bit of sweetness. So actually sort of beers, you know, like porter or stout work really well with blue cheese in general, but you know Madeira, port, anything with a bit of sweetness.
So Perry, to go back to your pear theme, Perry would be lovely with it.
That would be great. Yeah, that's a good idea. Perry and Roquefort, I've got to try that.
And what, so Roquefort, I mean, you've talked about this a lot, this incredible tradition, Patrick, but are there interesting developments in the world of Roquefort that you're coming across in your research?
Well, there's a few things that have cropped up. I mean, what's interesting, they did some research on Penicillium Roqueforti you know, they've named this mold after Roquefort. And historically, the reason that happened was the way that cheesemakers historically would get the mold into the milk before the, you know, we had culture houses and sort of commercial labs that would develop mold strains, which is what happens mm-hmm. now. You can buy a packet of penicillin Roquefort 40 and add it to your milk. But before that, people, the cheesemakers used to leave rye bread in the caves to go moldy. And so you'd get lots of blue mold naturally growing on the rye bread. They'd dry that out and actually crumble the moldy bread into the milk. And that was a way of inoculating the milk with the spores of the blue mold. And so for a long time, people have thought that the penicillin Roquefort 40 was in these caves, was in the soil or in the rocks, the limestone, in the fabric of the caves. But there was some research done in 2019 where they actually sort of took samples off the walls of the caves and couldn't find any penicillin Roquefort 40 actually in the caves. And so they think that the penicillin, that the spores of the blue mold are actually coming from either something that perhaps the sheep are eating, mm-hmm. and so it's or it's in the natural environment where the sheep are and is then sort of inoculating the milk in the dairy before the cheeses ever get to the caves, or perhaps there was something in the rye bread, you know, so it's actually the flour that had the spores in, and you make okay. the rye bread yeah. and yeah. the sort of the spores, the blue spores already in the bread. You probably don't actually need to mature Roquefort in the caves. But anyway, it is written into the law, so by law you do have to yes. mature them there. So so that was quite interesting, that, you know, this history around the caves being vitally important to giving the blue to the blue cheese is actually not necessarily true, which I thought was quite interesting.
It is interesting.
And what's the other thing that's happened? I mean, Roquefort production has declined steadily over the years. You know, it's a cheese that even in France is not as popular as it once were, it once was.
Right.
And that's partly because there's other styles of blue cheese in France that have grown up, you know, and, mm-hmm. and developed. And also Roquefort has, although it's protected and, a lot of the rules are enshrined, and, you know, raw milk and sheep breeds and so on, it is actually it's sort of dominated by one or two big companies who buy milk from lots of different farms and make on quite a large scale. So there's one called right. Société, which is owned by Lactalis, which is one of the big dairy multinationals. And I think Société accounts for sort of 60, maybe 70% of all Roquefort production.
Mm.
And so they own a lot of, I think they're sort of seven caves, and some of those caves are like networks of caves. And so Lactalis owns obviously a huge amount of the maturing space.
Right.
And so it's sort of slight, you know, it's one of those where, although it's protected, it has been sort of undermined, I think, a little bit over the years. So it's, you know, there's one or two very small producers left, but they're still buying milk from multiple farms. You know, there isn't a single farm based with one flock of sheep right. making Roquefort.
Yeah.
So that's definitely been a trend. The kind of, it's such a big brand, international brand, Roquefort,
mm-hmm.
that bigger players have moved in on it.
Are there interesting developments to that with the mold? I was just wondering if that was, are people experimenting with that, or was that too difficult?
No, well, yeah. So there has been, at Nottingham University, there was some research done looking at penicillin Roquefort 40. For a long time, it's thought that it was asexual. So it would kind of reproduce by itself. And the different strains that you found have been through sort of genetic glitches as the mold has sort of reproduced asexually. However, recently Nottingham University has discovered it is possible to cross strains and for penicillin Roquefort 40, different strains to be, you know, bred together
yeah.
to come up with new varieties. So this is not using GMO or anything like that. It's actually, you know, getting two different strains of Penicillin Rock 40, you know, turning the lights down, putting some soft music on. Yes. I don't know, candlelight dinner.
Going back to that shepherd's story, that, you know, there's a romance theme running through here, isn't there?
Yeah. So if you can get can get certain strains in the mood, you can cross them and they'll create new strains. And so that this is quite groundbreaking sort of development. So this there's a company that's been formed that is doing this called Mykonios, who are creating brand new strains of Penicillin Rock 40 naturally by crossing existing strains and finding strains of Penicillin Rock 40 in the wild and trying to cross them with those that have been cultured in labs. And they've come up with a range of new strains of Penicillin Rock 40 that work at, that will do different things, might have different colours, or they'll be more aggressive in how they break the cheese down, or more gentle, or, and so that's really interesting. And I know a lot of blue cheese makers, certainly in the UK, I know, I'm pretty sure a few Stilton makers have been talking to them and trying out new strains of Penicillin Rock 40 to develop interesting new blue cheeses. So that's quite an exciting development.
That is exciting. Yeah, that's brilliant.
Yeah.
I didn't know about that. Yeah, I mean, that's, and that must be great for the cheesemakers in a way to have a, you know, another, a new ingredient to play with. And perhaps, you know, we'll, perhaps we'll be back in a few years talking about, you know, new versions, cheeses, blue cheeses, you know, made with these new type of, these new Rock 40.
They just need to get those moulds in the mood, and hopefully we'll have lots of exciting new cheeses further down the line.
Lovely. Oh, Patrick, it was really lovely to talk to you. Thank you for that lovely journey. That was great. All right, take care. Thank you, Patrick.
My pleasure. Thanks, Jenny. Take care.
To find out more about Food FM and our content, go to foodfmradio.com.
Thank you so much for listening to A Slice of Cheese. I hope you've enjoyed it. If you have enjoyed it, it would be lovely if you could rate us on wherever you've found this podcast. It will make such a difference to us. So I hope you'll enjoy us again. Thank you very much.